This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The vast majority of climate scientists agree that climate change is happening, it's dangerous, and it's largely caused by human activities. The consensus is overwhelming, among the strongest ever seen in science. And yet, the American public is less than fully convinced. And there are those who adamantly insist that there is debate about the causes of climate change, or even that the whole thing is a hoax. How did we get into this surreal situation? That's the story that science historian Naomi Oreskes uncovered and laid out in a 2010 book she co-authored with Eric Conway, called Merchants of Doubt. It's now been made into a documentary film by the same name. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. I recently spoke with Naomi Oreskes, who joined me from a studio at WGBH in Boston. Naomi Oreskes, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you were actually, before you wrote Merchants of Doubt, working on a book about oceanography that you never finished. What was that book about?
Well, first of all, I just want to say I am finishing it now. So, but the book was about Cold War funding of American scientific research. And I was trying to answer the question, what difference does it make who funds scientific research? And how did this group of oceanographers negotiate the hope or the expectations of doing basic scientific research within a context and a framework that was deeply, deeply political and totally structured around a very specific geopolitical role, which was the containment of communism. And so that's what I was working on. And in the process of doing that work, I stumbled across the story of Roger Revelle and Dave Keeling and a group of other oceanographers who had been working on the question of man-made climate change going back to the 1950s. And one thing led to another, and that became the Merchants of Doubt project. So I put oceanography on hold, but I am happy to say that I am back to it and hoping to finish it this year.
What was it you found in digging into this longer history of climate science that got you so distracted that you had to completely switch gears?
Well, what I found was two things. First, I found that the history of climate science, of scientists working on the question of the potential impact of greenhouse gases, human activities on the climate, was much older and much more well-established than most people knew. Many people have heard of Dave Keeling and the Keeling Curve, but no one ever stops to ask, well, why did Dave Keeling begin measuring carbon dioxide in 1958 anyway? And the short answer was because scientists already recognized, even then, so more than half a century ago, that burning fossil fuels produces carbon dioxide that can, in fact, alter the climate of our Earth. And because they recognized that on basic fundamental physical principles, Dave and Roger Revelle had the idea that they should begin to measure carbon dioxide in order to test whether or not this was in fact having an impact. And I thought that was terribly important because already then and even now today, some people were saying, well, yes, of course, maybe there's some warming, but we don't know what's causing it. We don't, you know, nobody knows if it's human activities. And of course, that's completely, completely false. And this research showed that because it isn't that we realized there was climate change and then we were trying to scramble to figure it out. It's quite the opposite. It's that scientists predicted that there would be climate change based on basic fundamental science, and then began to do the work to see whether or not that prediction was coming true.
When you started to uncover this, you did kind of an exercise to see how strong, as of the early 2000s, the consensus on climate change was. And you went and you looked at 1,000 papers on the topic to see, you know, how much agreement or disagreement there was in the published studies about climate change. What did you find and how surprised were you as a scientist and a historian of scientists to see what the state of the science was at that point?
What I found in our study was that there was essentially no disagreement whatsoever. I had read many of the reports that had been written by the National Academy of Sciences, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and these reports by the early 2000s were already very, very clear that climate change was underway and that there was broad agreement in the scientific community about that question. But I was interested in whether or not there was potentially a gap between the leadership, who were saying, yes, we know this, and the rank and file of scientists. Because as we all know, in any walk of life, it's certainly possible for the leaders of organizations and institutions to say things that might not be consistent with what the rank and file believe. So I wanted to test that. And so I, as you said, I did a study with a sample of just about 1,000 papers in order to answer the question, how many of these papers published in peer-reviewed scientific literature by professional scientific researchers disagree with the conclusion that most of the observed warming that we were seeing at that time was caused by the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere? And what we found was that the answer was none. Zero.
Literally nothing. Zero out of 1,000
zero,
papers, not
literally
a single
zero.
One.
Yeah, well, it came out to be about 928 papers. Some of the papers in the original sample weren't actually about climate change, even though they had the words climate change in their abstracts. But once we focused on this core of 928 papers, correct, the answer was not a single paper. So that was a surprising result because, you know, I think most people at that time had the impression that there was some real scientific debate continuing on the issue. And to discover that there was none, well, that was a pretty startling result.
I find that startling even today, having spent years reporting on climate change. And we see figures like there's a 97% consensus or 99% consensus. But you're saying 100% unanimous. Has that changed in the intervening 10 years? Have there been studies that have come out perhaps adding some uncertainty?
No, it's that the more recent studies are much bigger. So our study, you know, when we did this back in 2003, it was just a relatively small sample. It wasn't really even intended to be a big deal. If I'd known what a big deal it would be, I might have done a few things a little bit differently. It was just a kind of check. I was mostly going on, my understanding of the issue was mostly based on my own reading of the literature, my own understanding of this history, which I've already mentioned goes back to the 1950s, and the reports that had been produced by the IPCC and the National Research Council, National Academy of Sciences, who represent the mainstream scientific community. But it was just a kind of double check. I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't a gap between my understanding, what these reports said, and what was actually in the peer-reviewed literature. So I think my study clearly showed that there was no gap. Now, since then, there's been so much more work done, so it certainly would be possible that the additional work would raise some new questions. But mainly what the new studies do is that they just have much, much, much larger samples. So they've captured a much bigger range of scientific work and scientific opinion. And so what you find, and not at all surprising, with a much larger sample, a little bit of disagreement, dissent pops up, but it's still incredibly minor. And as you pointed out, you said 97 or 99. That new study, the much bigger, more recent study, is often quoted as 97%. But if you actually read the study, and again, this is one of the things we learn, is that most people don't actually read. But if you actually read the study, what you find actually, 97% of the scientists say they agree. 1% say they disagree. And 2% say they're not sure. So that's consistent with our earlier result, that essentially there's nearly unanimous agreement among the scientific community, among people who have worked on the issue and actually have an opinion.
As you said, you did this essentially as an exercise to fact check yourself. But when you saw how strong the consensus was, you knew you had something important to share with scientific colleagues and also with the public. The response to that, though, was something I don't know if anybody could have predicted. Talk about the response that when you published this study saying that there is nearly unanimous consensus that climate change is happening and largely human-caused, what happened?
Well, two things happened. First of all, it got picked up by Al Gore's team, and it appeared, the study appeared as a slide in Al Gore's talk show talk in the film An Inconvenient Truth. And what the vice president did in his talk was to juxtapose it with the work of Max and Jules Boykoff, who had looked at how the media were presenting the question of man-made climate change. And Max and Jules Boykoff had shown that the media was presenting this as a big debate, often giving roughly equal space in print media to the contrarian position as to the mainstream scientific view, whereas my study showed that there was no disagreement among scientists. So these two studies together showed that the media had grossly, grossly misrepresented the state of scientific debate. And Vice President Gore made a point about this in the film. So when that happened, then a second thing occurred, which was that I started getting hate email. I started getting threatening phone calls. I was attacked by Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, and I started being accused of all kinds of strange things like being a Stalinist, being a communist, wanting to suppress scientific debate, being an enemy of science, all kinds of very weird things. And it was that sort of through the looking glass moment when all of a sudden my life changed and my world changed, that then I began to ask the question, well, who are these people and why are they attacking me for what I thought was, as you just said, a simple fact check? I was trying to be a conscientious historian and do a cross check on my own work. And now I publish this result and I am suddenly being demonized by a U.S. senator. So that was a pretty weird experience. I can tell you that.
How did you handle that? The hate mail, the threats, this, as you call it, demonization. What kind of toll does that take emotionally or even physically?
Well, it does take a toll. And there was a difficult period there for a little while when I was trying to understand what was going on. But the main way I handled it was to try to understand what was happening. And I suppose the great thing about being a historian is that everything that crosses your desk is potentially material. I suppose it's like being a journalist, too. So I started talking to colleagues about what was happening, initially mainly for moral support. But then some colleagues started saying to me, well, what's happening to you, these attacks sound similar to some other things that have happened to scientists that we know, to Ben Santer, who was the scientist who wrote the lead author on the key chapter in the second IPCC report that said that climate change was underway, or Sherry Rowland, the great atmospheric chemist who accurately predicted that certain chemicals would deplete the ozone layer. So I actually called up these people. I talked to Ben, I talked to Sherry Rowland, I talked to some other colleagues, and pretty soon a picture began to emerge. A picture began to emerge that what was happening to me was part of a larger pattern of scientists, almost all scientists up until now. I think I might have been the first historian of science to get attacked, but initially scientists, but then also historians of science, being attacked for scientific work, scientific evidence related to important social issues like the ozone hole and climate change and the harms of tobacco. And when I realized that this whole story was actually linked to tobacco, and that some of the same people who were attacking me had actually previously worked with the tobacco industry, that's when I realized there was a story to be told. And that's when the sad oceans had to be put on the back burner.
The consensus, as you said, among climate scientists is nearly unanimous. But some work has shown that there's perhaps slightly less adherence to that consensus among physical scientists and engineers. It's mostly physicists who have been involved in this pushback against the link between tobacco and lung cancer, that have been involved in a number of these different campaigns you mentioned, pushing back against, in every case, what seemed to be the scientific consensus. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's important to clarify, first of all, that most of the people who question climate science are not scientists. So we have to make this very clear, that the vast majority of scientists understand the science and respect the work of their scientific colleagues. But among those people who don't accept it, who are vocal, outspoken, or have been involved in campaigns to challenge scientific knowledge, what we discovered was that there was this sort of peculiar fact, was that among those who actually were scientists, they were almost all physicists. And so that was the story we tried to explain. Why would... And they weren't just physicists. They were extremely important physicists, distinguished physicists. One of the people we ended up studying was Frederick Seitz, who was an extremely famous solid-state physicist who was, in fact, the president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in the 1960s. But in the 1970s, he goes to work with R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. So we wanted to answer the question, why would brilliant, distinguished physicists do this? Why would they attack the work of their colleagues? Why would they make common cause with the tobacco industry? And why would they defend a product, tobacco, that they knew was killing people?
And what's the answer?
And so the answer is that it was essentially ideological. Most people thought that we were going to tell a story about scientists selling out for money. But what we really found, again, at least with these people, it's not to say money's not part of the story, but with this key set of physicists, it really had, as far as we could tell, essentially nothing to do with money. I mean, Fred Seitz did get paid for the work he did, but the deeper motivation was a political and ideological motivation that actually came out of their experience as physicists in the Cold War. So Fred Seitz and his colleagues, Bill Nuremberg, Bob Jastrow, Fred Singer, were all Cold War physicists. They had all worked on weapons and rocketry programs in the 50s and 60s and 70s even. And they all had come to positions of power and influence as a result of the work that they had done in the Cold War. And they believed very strongly, and I think this belief was authentically held, that they had kept the United States safe from communism, that they had helped to contain communism. So the way the story goes a little off the rails, though, is that then they become very, very ideologically opposed to any government intervention in the marketplace. And they begin to see any regulation, whether it's tobacco control or, you know, controlling the chemicals that deplete ozone, any kind of government intervention in the marketplace as potentially threatening to put us on a slippery slope to socialism. That once the government intervenes in the marketplace, let's say to protect us from the harms of tobacco, then there's essentially no limit to how much the government can intervene in our lives. And before you know it, we're going to be living under the yoke of totalitarianism. And this, of course, was an argument that the tobacco industry used to very, very great effect in the 60s and 70s to argue against government control of tobacco. And we know from his own writings that Fred Seitz definitely agreed with that argument. And we have lots of other evidence from these other people as well, that they really thought that they were defending freedom and democracy. The problem, of course, is not the defense of freedom. All of us believe in freedom and all of us believe in democracy. The problem is the strange strategies and tactics they took, which included misrepresenting the scientific evidence, misrepresenting the state of scientific consensus, and attacking in a very unprincipled way, not just the science, but also the scientists who had done the work.
That's science historian Naomi Oreskes, author of Merchants of Doubt. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is science historian Naomi Oreskes. Her book, Merchants of Doubt, now a movie, tells the story of a small group of scientists and others who have spread messages of skepticism about not only climate science, but also the link between CFCs and the ozone hole and between smoking and lung cancer. There's been a lot of research in the past several years in the field of psychology, in the social sciences, looking more broadly at this phenomenon of how our deeply held beliefs influence the ways that we take in and assimilate or do not assimilate factual information when it's presented to us. And this has been used to explain perhaps why there is such a gap between the public perception of the consensus on climate change, the fact that, 65, 70, 75%, depending on the study and exactly how the question's worded, but, you know, somewhere around 70% of Americans are on board with the consensus that climate change is happening and caused largely by humans when, as we've mentioned multiple times, that's nearly a unanimous consensus among scientists. How much credence do you give or how much weight do you give to this psychological kind of underpinning for why we can't necessarily always take the facts on board? I mean, it seems like that's a lot of what you're talking about with these scientists and in some cases non-scientists who get on board with these anti-consensus campaigns, and how much of it is, as you mentioned, perhaps money or some other motivation.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that, as you said, about 70% of the American people, depending on the poll, are on board, as you put it, with the scientific evidence. And that's actually a really important result. It's very important for us not to overstate, you know, the degree of confusion that occurs among the American people. The American people are not stupid. And I think most people have now had the opportunity to understand, you know, why they may have been confused before, why scientists say the evidence is so strong. And from a political standpoint, if we have 70, 75% of the American people on board, that's extremely powerful. So, you know, that's a little bit of hope and good news in a story which is otherwise rather depressing and demoralizing. So I always want to emphasize the good news where we have it. But I think that, in a way, is the key issue. Climate change is a bad news story. It's a story about a very, very profound problem, a problem that we made, that we did. We didn't do it deliberately. We didn't do it knowingly. We did it accidentally. But now we do know, and now we need to do something about it. And if we don't do something about it, huge numbers of people will be hurt, and billions or trillions of dollars in damages will occur. So this is a very serious bad news story. So what do we do about it? Well, nobody likes bad news. all of us would rather not listen to bad news. Many of us turn off the television when bad things come on the news. So it's not surprising that many American people have been a bit resistant to accepting that this is true. And so if someone comes along and says, well, you know, it isn't true. Listen to me. I have a different explanation. I can blame this on sunspots, or I can blame this on volcanoes. All of us are going to be at least a little bit tempted to listen to that story, and some of us will believe it.
How much of a fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the process of science and how science works do you think that this gap reveals?
I think that's huge. And as a historian of science, that's one of the things that I've been trying to talk about in my public lectures and in my TED talk that I recently did. So I hope your listeners, if they have time, can go look up my TED talk.
We'll have a link to that on our website as well.
Oh, terrific. Thank you. Most of us have a vision of science that's very much focused on the idea of the individual genius, the genius like Albert Einstein or, you know, Isaac Newton, who has a eureka moment. The apple falls on Newton's head. And that's a very, very misleading view of science. The reality that we know from the work of scientists and historians and philosophers of science is that science is very much a community activity. And although it's true that individuals play a role, that individual genius, of course, is important, and that the creative production of ideas is very, very important, and that may happen in a moment of insight. But what makes scientific knowledge knowledge is not the moment when the apple falls on Newton's head, if that even in fact ever happened, but it's the process by which the claims are judged. So the verification or the confirmation of scientific knowledge is based on a process in which claims are subject to the scrutiny of a larger community. Scientists bring ideas to meetings, they present the data and the evidence. Colleagues ask questions, they raise concerns. Then those results are published in peer-reviewed journals where they're reviewed again by experts who again look through it for problems, for mistakes, for errors. So work doesn't get published until it's been vetted by colleagues. And then even then, the process of investigation of discovery continues and the scientific community doesn't converge on a consensus until a tremendous amount of work has been done by very, very many people. So if now one person comes along and says, well, I don't agree, as a historian of science, that doesn't trouble me in the least. I think, well, of course, you know, there's always going to be some disagreement. And in a way, it's good. If someone comes along and says, I disagree, that's good. That shows that the scientific community is healthy, that there is ongoing discussion. And if someone really has some new data, people are ready and willing to listen to it. But the problem in this public sphere is that that one person who says, I disagree, gets promoted, and it's not just on Fox News. It could be it could be on WGBH. It could be in the New York Times. It could be in a lot of different places. That person gets promoted, and particularly on television, we see this phenomenon where you'll have that person now debating a scientist. So the impression that is given to the public is that this is a debate of roughly equal proportions. So this glorification of the individual really undermines our understanding of the process by which reliable scientific knowledge is produced.
You mentioned earlier the seminal work of Max and Jules Boykoff, their first paper around the same time you were uncovering this consensus showing that the kind of elite print media, at least, was portraying this as a more equal debate when, in fact, it was almost unanimously one-sided. A few years later, though, they came back and looked at it and said there's already been a huge shift in the way this issue is being portrayed in the mainstream media, in the elite media in the United States. It's now mostly being portrayed as a fairly one-sided issue. How much do you think has changed in the media portrayal, in the public perception of this issue since you started working on it a little over 10 years ago?
I think the media portrayal is definitely better. I think Max and Jules Boykoff's work shows that. I think any of us who follow this issue have seen that. So we definitely feel a whole lot better. It's much more gratifying to look at media coverage of the issue now. It's certainly much more accurate than it was before. But I still get asked about the question all the time, including by journalists. And sometimes journalists will ask me, well, why do you think we did this? And then I want to say, well, I really think that's a question you guys have to answer. So I think the journalistic community needs to look at this question more closely, because here's the problem. Even though it's true, it's much better now, I think a lot of damage got done. There was certainly a period of time when more than half the American people thought that scientists were still arguing long after that was in fact the case. So we know that progress on this issue got delayed, and I do think that the media representation played a role in that delay. I also worry about it because I think the media are clued in now on the specific issue of climate, but I'm not sure whether or not the media have generalized that to realize that this is a broader problem. And I say that because now I sometimes see media coverage of some new issue that is emerging, and sometimes I see the same pattern seem to be emerging there. So I think there's a tendency of journalists to fall back into this, well, what we call false equivalence. And part of that is because, of course, people like Max and Jules and myself and others have done tremendous work to make the media aware of the way in which the representation of climate science was inaccurate. But the equivalent work hasn't been done for many, many other issues where this question comes up as well.
So we need a sea change, not just a change with regard to one particular issue.
That's the way I would view it. And I think journalists need to really think through that, you know, the idea of balance as a measure of objectivity is not really accurate. That, you know, the first job of reporting is accuracy, and accuracy can come in many different forms. So if 99% of the scientists believe one thing and 1% believe something else, then the accurate way to represent that is to say 99% of scientists believe this and 1% believe something else.
Your book, Merchants of Doubt, has now been made into a movie that is playing in Boston and elsewhere around the country. Do you think that a movie about this topic can reach a broader audience and start to counteract some of that, you know, essentially hangover from the period of misrepresentation in the mainstream media?
We know that movies can reach much broader audiences, and that, of course, was one of the reasons that Eric Conway and I were excited to work with Robbie Kenner on in turning our book into a film, because even though the book had been successful and sold very well by the standard of books, very, very few books reach, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of people, whereas even a fairly serious documentary has the potential to reach, you know, many, many, many more orders of magnitude more people than books. So we were very excited to have the opportunity to work with Robbie Kenner to make a film. And we also realized working with Robbie, I mean, of course, we knew this before, film is a much more visceral and a much more emotional medium than print is. So if you want to get at the emotional core of an issue, that's incredibly helpful. And of course, we know people, you know, people do listen to facts and they do make decisions in part based on factual information. But we also know that people also make decisions based on emotional responses, and that's not necessarily wrong. Our emotional responses to things are often right. So the idea of a film that could complement what we had done in the book was great, and we're so excited, you know, we're really excited that this has come to fruition. Really grateful also to Participant Media, our production company. Whether or not it will change the situation, though, of course, is a much bigger question, and no one can really predict that. I think that we see that the resistance to action on climate change is still extremely, extremely powerful and strong. And, you know, the American people are on board about this issue, but our leadership, to a large extent, is not. And if one just thinks about the recent events in Florida, where the governor there forbade state employees working on a report on sea level rise to discuss climate change or global warming, to use either of those terms, even though we know beyond any reasonable doubt that what's driving sea level rise is climate change, global warming. So that's a very, I have to say, it's a kind of frightening state of affairs. It's very Orwellian. In the book, we talked about the Orwellian quality of some of the denial campaigns. And it's very frightening to me. And it's especially, of course, ironic that people who think they're defending democracy are, in fact, using Orwellian tactics, which, of course, was exactly what Orwell warned us about, not expecting Democrats to do that, but expecting fascists and totalitarians to do that.
The press packet for the Merchants of Doubt movie describes it as satirically comedic. How do you make a movie about this surreal, Orwellian, frightening, depressing? I mean, all words that you've, you know, used in the past half an hour. How do you make this story satirically comedic?
Well, of course, that's a tricky thing. And, you know, viewers will have to decide for themselves if they think it is comedic. I was at a screening last week where, you know, people were laughing. People were also hissing at certain parts and booing. Our new book, my new book with Eric Conway, The Collapse of Western Civilization, is somewhat comedic. And my editor said when he read it, he loved it because it was actually very funny in a sort of Dr. Strangelovian way, which I took as a, one of the best compliments I ever got in my whole life. It's hard to explain exactly. I mean, I think it is a kind of black humor. There are ironies and paradoxes that we bring to bear. So, you know, I mean, comedy is one of the worst things to analyze, right? It's like trying to analyze why you fell in love. So I think the movie does succeed in being funny in places. I think it also succeeds in being, you know, very moving in places and very thought-provoking. It's a mix, and I think that's, you know, part of Robbie Kenner's genius, that he could make a serious film about a serious topic, but also make it interesting, engaging, and in places, indeed, funny.
I have to ask, as a scientist and a historian of science, as in journalism, perhaps the most important thing you have is your reputation of objectivity. Is what you're doing now, does that cross a line into advocacy? Are you on a crusade? And does that in any way compromise your scientific or historical objectivity?
Well, I'm definitely not on a crusade, and I don't think any historian would ever want to use the word crusade to describe any work that we did. I think many of us found it very frightening when President George W. Bush used the word crusade to discuss political action in the Middle East. So, you know, let's set that aside completely. There's a more subtle and complicated issue about what objectivity really is and what the standpoint of a scholar should be when he or she discovers something that have real consequences for society. So you're absolutely right that once we begin to engage with society, certain kinds of scientific or academic ideals of detachment then are challenged because we're not being detached anymore. We're saying, yes, we need to be engaged with society. These are real issues people need to understand, people need to know about, and yes, indeed, people need to act on it. So if you define objectivity as detachment, then I think you do have a problem. But if you define objectivity as doing your level best as a professional to really understand the issue, to do serious research, to delve into the documents, and to tell the story as best as the evidence allows you to, and let the chips fall where they may, then I think you are being objective. And that's what we did in Merchants of Doubt. We didn't set out with an agenda. We didn't know who these people even really were when we started working. I mean, we knew them as distinguished and important scientists, and Bill Nierenberg was someone I knew personally. But it's not like we weren't climate activists when we started this work. In fact, quite the opposite. We were scholars and academics. Neither Eric nor I had done any work on climate change before this story kind of fell on our, you know, fell in our laps. So, you know, we didn't start with an agenda. We didn't start with any kind of predisposed idea about what the answer to this story would be. And we told the story as we found it, which is why the book Merchants of Doubt has footnotes. You know, has extensive documentation. It's why we built a web page where there are links to some of the key documents so anyone who has questions can go and look at the documents for themselves. So, you know, this is a very, very evidence-based project, and we've always been quite scrupulous about stressing the evidentiary basis. I just want to say one other thing, too, about the issue of detachment versus attachment. I think that when scientists make discoveries that have important social consequences, there's actually a social responsibility to speak up and explain them to the American people. And if that includes explaining what needs to be done based on the scientific evidence, then I think that is part of the job of scholars. And my role model in this is Sherry Rowland, who won the Nobel Prize for his work predicting the ozone hole. So Sherry Rowland won the Nobel Prize, science at the very, very highest possible level. So nobody could say he was a bad scientist. But Sherry became very involved first in explaining what it was he had found, and then in actually becoming an advocate for saying that we had to do something to control the chemicals that were causing ozone depletion. He didn't say what that something had to be. Like, that is to say, he didn't cross over and tell politicians how to do their job and what the specific policy remedy would be, but he certainly said we had to do something. And when he was asked whether he had crossed a line into activism, he said, well, what is the point in understanding the science and accurately predicting this problem if we then just sit around and wait for it to come true?
On that note, Naomi Oreskes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure speaking with you.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. She's co-author of the 2010 book Merchants of Doubt, also another climate change-related book called, upliftingly, The Collapse of Western Civilization. If you're at all curious about that one, we have a Q&A with Naomi Oreskes on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu.